right, ladies and gentlemen, what this is all about, as I spoke of earlier, is an interview with a fellow whose name is Stan Wilson, and we know that Stan was on his way in his Permi bus to St. Paul, right, Stan?
Right.
And you were...
Minneapolis to St. Paul.
And I'm going to ask you to speak up as much as you can. I think I'm probably overwhelming you a bit. Tell us, before we get into this, if you wouldn't mind telling us a little about your background. How is it that you ended up rolling around the United States training people as to how to grow things and this... method that you offer. Where did this all begin in your life?
Okay, well, through a variety of circumstances, my wife comes from a very, very rural background. So, of course, her family was raised here in southwestern Minnesota, and they did a lot of canning and food preparation, and they were farmers. So a lot of the skills that we're teaching are skills that I actually picked up from her family. I was a city kid, and I had far more of a political background when we met, and we, you know, through our life experience, we spent a lot of time doing things like teaching folks how to do things like canned food. And a couple of years ago, after she got out of college, she wanted to have some time in between her, getting her BA and going into graduate school, and wanted to see if she couldn't become involved in a couple of nonprofit projects before going into graduate school. And we'd all, you know, we talked about making it official that if we had this information that people obviously wanted, then we wanted to do something official to go about the country and show folks how to do things like can their own food and become more sustainable and more, you know, and more self-sufficient. And a couple of years back in 2007, we had been introduced to Starhawk and to the work that she does with activism and the work she does with permaculture. And I went to an Earth Activist training, which is a two-week intensive permaculture design training that's also mixed with activism and Earth-based spirituality, and graduated from that. And that really cemented in us the need to take this message on the road and start talking with folks about how we can become more energy self-sufficient and how we can become more water self-sufficient and more food self-sufficient, because these are the major areas in which people bump heads with corporations and with governments and become very, very dependent on corporate and government sources for our water and our food and our energy. And the joke at the time was is that we had a little Honda that we were driving around in, and it was going to be us and our Honda. And Starhawk, who was one of the co-founders of the Earth Activist Training, had always dreamed of having a converted school bus that would go out and go to fairs and festivals and demonstrate things like solar energy and how to use gray water and how to grow food organically and talk about permaculture and about energy self-sufficiency. And so we ended up putting the two ideas together, and in March of 2007 we were awarded a $10,000 grant by the Earth Activist Training, and then in May of 2007 we purchased the bus, the Permi bus. It's the Earth Activist Training demonstration bus. We call it lovingly the Permi bus, and began setting it up so that we could go on the road. And in the meantime, both my wife and my daughter took an Earth Activist Training course, and then my wife and I both took an Advanced Earth Activist Training course.
Where do you take this Earth Activist training?
The ones we went to were in California. They're in Northern California, this little Black Mountain Preserve, which is a Buddhist retreat.
Really? Wow.
And outside of Casadero, California, which is a little town in Northern California where Starhawk has a little piece of property up there. And, you know, it's a two-week intensive course that is a permaculture design course. And out of the course that my wife took, one of the projects was setting up the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And so on February 21st, we left San Francisco, and we began our training tour. And what we had done is that we have a rather extensive network of people we know across the United States, because we've both been doing environmental and social justice-based activism for the last 25 years or so.
Oh, wow.
And we developed an announcement and it listed all the trainings we were capable of doing, and we sent that out to our friends, and we asked them to send it out to the list that they were on, and by word of mouth and by the internet, we began gathering places where people wanted us to go. And one of the earliest things that were set up is that was a thing called the Midtown Farmers Market in Minneapolis. And we made arrangements very, very early on to be at the Midtown Market and do a permaculture training there. And August happens to be, I think for the first time this year, National Permaculture Month. And August 2nd was National Permaculture Day. So we had set up well in advance to be here and do the permaculture training. And so while we were traveling around the country and doing trainings in a variety of different places, we had in our mind that we had to be in Minneapolis on August 2nd.
I see. Stan, before we get to that, I have a couple of questions that I'd really like to get straight in my head. First, you said you got a $10,000 grant from Earth Activist. Is that the same people where you took your training?
It's the same people where we took the training. It was a $10,000 grant, and the Earth Activist training is an organization that's a nonprofit.
And how do they get funding?
I am not a good money person.
Neither
am I.
And
I know that they have a variety of different groups that they work with who are fiscal sponsors. Mm-hmm. And there's a wide variety of people across the country and in the United States that support permaculture. There's actually a very, very wide worldwide permaculture network.
Really?
And there's different granting foundations who supply money for projects such as these. And there's a lot of nonprofits who are very, very interested right now in self-sufficiency and sustainability.
Do you think there are any wealthy or semi-wealthy people that throw money at these things, or do you think it's basically all people with limited income that donate?
Well, I think there's a variety of different people who are donors. I think, there's always those people who are wealthy, who have a sense of what we used to refer to as noblesse oblige,
mm-hmm.
who see, one of the things they want to do is use their privilege for philanthropy. But, like any other nonprofit group, most of the money that comes from those people who are, they're middle class, they have limited incomes, and they're sending in small amounts of money to do what they can to help be supportive. And that creates the bulk, in my experience, mm-hmm. of most nonprofit funding.
Is it possible? Oh, there we go. There was a little buzz happening. Now it's gone. Another thing you said the terms earth-based spirituality. Could you expand on that a little for us?
Well, it's earth-based spirituality is the idea of the sense that the earth is a living, breathing being that, and we as people are all part of this entity that makes up the earth, and we are all connected. And so, earth-based spirituality is involved in care of the earth, and a reverence for this planet that keeps us alive. That is our living support system.
Does it include the notion that there is more than the earth, that there is something else out there, that perhaps when things die they in some manner live on?
Well, there's a variety of different, Native Americans would come under the heading probably of earth-based spirituality, so there's a variety of different beliefs. And my belief, I believe in a greater creator that is responsible, that is the creative unit, the initiator of creation. And I went back and forth with the idea of what happens after death. And, I've really come to believe that, we have a choice in our life of whether we're going to have a heaven or a hell. And to me, the entire planet is the garden. And if we take care of it, we create a heaven. And in the afterlife, we have the privilege of our souls living on in this afterlife. That is a place that, if you come from a Christian background, you would refer to as a heaven. And if we continue on with the practices that we continue on, what we do is we turn the garden that we were given by our Creator into the hell that, that is spoken about.
Well, this would certainly fit with karma, ideas of karma or cause and effect. It's as as likely as any I've heard. I also have battled with this and come to believe that there has to be something beyond what we see and feel around us. And I've been listening to Deepak Chopra, I confess, and he calls it the conscious energy field. Now, one other thing, I think by now we've probably got those listening that don't understand what permaculture is really curious. So could you tell us, what is permaculture?
Well, permaculture was developed actually, and it's two Australians, Bill Mollison and David Holdrum, are credited with being the creator, the founders of permaculture as the form that is followed now. It actually began in the 1920s in Korea and the Orient, and what permaculture does is it combines, there's social permaculture and then there's the original form of permaculture, which comes from the combination of the words permanent and agriculture. And that's a very, very indigenous mindset, the idea that as residents of an area, we are permanent residents of an area, and therefore the way we treat the place where we live, our environment, we treat it as if we have always been there, we are always going to be there, and the generations that succeed us will always be in this place. So it engenders a tremendous amount of a need to take care of and, in fact, rejuvenate, you know, the environment in which we live. And then there's social permaculture, which is a combination of the word permanent and culture. And that's pretty much the same idea that the environment in which we live, the culture in which we live, is a permanent culture. It has always been here and it is always going to be there, and therefore it becomes our responsibility to love it and nurture it and ensure that, you know, it's the idea of like the seventh generation, to ensure that the generations that succeed us are given something that has been improved upon from what we received. And so, you know, permaculture was created as a way to counterbalance the Green Revolution of the 70s, where, you know, we went out to feed the world and had slogans like "Make the Desert Bloom," and it really, really looked at farming as an agribusiness, as an extractive industry. And what we've done with the idea of farming as an extractive industry is that we've depleted soils, poisoned rivers and lakes, and have made, you know, drastic changes in climate by putting pollutants into the air. And this is a way of looking at our environment as that it was a living, breathing entity that we need to care for and, in fact, make improvements upon. And it really came out of the study of indigenous cultures. And in the case of Holdrum and Mollison, they were in Australia, so they spent a lot of time studying agricultural-based communities in places like Papua New Guinea, where people have been farming there and living there for somewhere in the neighborhood of 25,000 years. And their view of the place is that we have always been here, we always will be here. So, of course, you know, we tend to garden, and we practice, our practices are all rejuvenative. And so out of their studies, they came up with the idea of permaculture, and they came up with ethics and principles to guide permaculture. And the ethics that guide permaculture and guide the way in which permaculturalists interact with their environment is earth care, caring for the earth, people care, and that's, you know, caring for those entities. And in my belief, I extend people care to include all the living beings around me, caring for them, and then fair share. And that's caring, you know, that's sharing the abundance which we create with everybody around us as equally as we can.
Fantastic. When you teach these methods, however, what are you actually showing people how to grow things in a certain way, or...
Well, what we do is we discuss different ways, and the idea of growing food, for instance, we discuss different ways of growing food. And right now we have we have two things which we're looking at primarily, and that is urban permaculture, and that's taking these practices and bringing them into urban areas. And the reason for that is simply demographics. Most of the world's population lives in urban areas right now. And we're also looking at how to take these practices and bring them to the poor. And again, that's really simply demographics. Most of the world's population lives in poverty, and in fact, 40% of the American population lives below the official poverty line. So if these solutions aren't urban-based and they're not poor, they're not poverty-based, we don't really view them as being solutions at all. So what we do is we come into areas and we talk with people about how you can create these closed-loop systems where, you know, the goal is to have no waste whatsoever. It usually begins by serious reductions of waste and, you know, and looking at things through a series of principles that make it so that you're really, really taking a lot of time to observe what is going on and try to find solutions out of the problems. You know, a case in being is, you know, global climatic change or global warming. One of the biggest things that we talk to people about doing, one of the biggest solutions people can come up can as an individual can enact to combat global climatic change is to plant an organic garden. When you plant an organic garden, you sequester carbon in the soil where it belongs, where it's no longer a problem, and take it out of the atmosphere. And the byproduct of that is that you now have good organic food that you can eat and that you can share with your neighbors. And if you extend that into the social permaculture idea, you know, then you start having community organic gardens where the entire community, the entire neighborhood comes together to care for the earth and to share the abundance.
Do you see this movement constantly going forward and growing?
Right now, I think that, you know, I think right now is the time. And one of the things that we've gotten out of being on this tour is that there is a real desire to have these trainings, to have this information, to have a way of looking at the problem in a sense of where the problem becomes the solution, to where, you know, what can we do different oftentimes becomes the question, and what can we do different in a manner to where it's actually doable for us. You know, one of our mission statement says that, you know, our goal is to cultivate revolutionary ways of living. And the way we do that is that we really believe that people make changes at the margins. They do the small things they can do instead of, you know, the really, really big things that we always seem to want people to do. You know, and if everybody makes these small changes at the margins in their life, by the time we're all done doing that, we will have, in fact, cultivated a revolutionary way of living, being a sustaining, regenerative way of living in our environment. And I would say right now is the time, and what I've learned in this trip is that people want this, and they really, really desire it, and they're really, really hungry for it. People want to do things different, and they don't necessarily know what those things are that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
The problem seems so huge, and oftentimes the solutions are so esoteric that they can't really latch on to them, so they end up doing nothing.
But it's possible that as this grows, you know, just this conversation we're having is influencing me, and I'm sure it's influencing people who are listening. And so it goes that it spreads little by little, and it's conceivable that at some point it will pass over a line, and maybe Stan Wilson and his family will someday be looked upon as pioneers who helped us turn this tide of agribusiness and all the other things that are destroying our planet, and will be looked upon as people who saved our planet. Wouldn't that be something? So now,
I think that's happening. This grassroots movement is really catching on, and it's beginning to affect, you know, official policy in different areas. And, you know, it's really, people are really, really grasping onto it because it's something that they can do, and it's something they can be successful at.
Right. So with this backdrop, let us proceed now and have you tell us, you know, without having to go through all the all the details. There must be many, many details, but essentially what happened is you drove into Minneapolis, and then bring us up to date with what's happening now.
Okay, so we came into Minneapolis on August 2nd, and we did a permaculture training at the Midtown Farmers Market, and we stayed in the Minneapolis area. And one of the things we came into Minneapolis to do is each of our members to address our grievances against our government. The Republican National Convention is, you know, recently has just done ending their convention in St. Paul. And what we were going to do is we were going to do a series of urban permaculture trainings around the convention, and also my wife and I were both going to offer support in the form of taking care of people and doing medical support for the people who are going to be protesting, because, you know, the government does things that injure people when they attempt.
Excuse me, Stan, I hate to interrupt you, but could you speak up a little more and maybe hold that phone real steady?
Sure.
Okay, great.
And, you know, and so we had done a variety of different trainings around how to take care of yourself in the street and how to be safe in the street and, you know, what kind of clothes you should wear, you know, what kind of things you should bring with you, like make sure you have plenty of water and that sort of thing. And on August 30th, I had just finished doing an urban permaculture training at the Bedlam Theater, which is in Minneapolis, and we were getting ready to drive over to St. Paul, where we were going to spend a couple of days visiting with friends just to take it easy for the weekend before the convention started. And we had left Minneapolis. We had, you know, four passengers with us that we were giving a ride to. It was my wife and my daughter and I. And we got onto the freeway, and we had just entered St. Paul when I noticed that there was a St. Paul police officer behind me who had his lights on, and so I pulled over. I pulled over on the exit 237, and I saw in front of me there was two state troopers sitting on the side of the road who had their lights on, which I thought was a little unusual. And I pulled over, and we were quickly surrounded by what in the end turned out to be 11 different police vehicles with 15 officers from 5 different jurisdictions.
Oh, jeez.
And they ordered us off the bus and proceeded to take some of the people into their cars and question them. They handcuffed one person because they said that she didn't comply quickly enough. I tried to ascertain why we were being stopped. Eventually, I was told that this was a routine traffic stop, and, you know, I expressed the idea that I'd been pulled over before for, you know, having the brake light out or whatever, and I never had, you know, I'd never been surrounded by 5 different jurisdictions. And at some point, after we were trying to interact with the police to find out what was going on, they announced that they were going to impound the bus. And of course, we asked them why. And at this point, they had never done anything. They had my driver's license, but they had never done anything like ask for my registration or my proof of insurance. And they brought a tow truck, and we asked them why they were impounding the bus. And initially, we were told that they were impounding the bus in case they wanted to execute a search at a later date. And we explained to them that that violated our Fourth Amendment rights of, you know, protection from illegal search and seizure.
Right on.
But if they wanted to search the bus, they had to have a search warrant, and they had to present it to us. And then they said they were seizing the bus to see if it was a commercial vehicle, and we talked about how it was legally registered in the state of Montana as a private vehicle. And then they said they were seizing the bus to do a roadside test, and we questioned the validity of that. And finally, I was told by Officer Davis, who was the Minnesota State Trooper and commercial vehicle investigator, that they were seizing the bus because they were ordered to. And they, you know, they allowed us to take our dogs off the bus, they allowed us to take our chickens off the bus, and they allowed us to take some animal food off the bus. But the rest of our personal possessions, including my daughter's shoes, remained on the bus.
Oh my God.
And they took the bus off and left us on the side of the road. You know, and luckily we have a network of friends and supporters who were able to come and get us and take us to a place to where we were safe and we were indoors. And then we began the process of interacting with the city of Minneapolis and trying to find out what we could do to get our bus back and why, in fact, it was taken.
How many chickens did you have standing there?
We have three chickens.
Three chickens.
That are part of our teaching,
and in little cages.
We have one of those, you know, those large sized dog kennels that
mm-hmm.
you fly your animals around in.
I sure do.
They stay in one of those when they're riding in the bus, and then we have an outdoor kennel that we can fold up so it's easily stored that we keep on the bus. That when we come to a location where we're going to mm-hmm. Where we can set them up, we put the fence up and can put them outside.
So there you are standing alongside the road with three chickens and three dogs. What kind of dogs?
We have two Australian Shepherds.
Oh.
Who are 7 years old and 5 years old, and then we have a 16-year-old miniature schnauzer.
Oh my gosh. What are the names of the dogs?
The Australian Shepherds are Rowan, she's the 6-year-old, and then, I mean the 7-year-old, and then Sage is 5, Sage is her younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
They're not litter mates, but they're from the same mother and father. In fact, mm-hmm. we have a friend who lives in Ohio who has the father, and used to be my daughter's dog, and then my sister-in-law actually has the mother. And then Poco is the little schnauzer.
Wow. So now you, and one other point I wanted to get in there is you were headed for St. Paul because you knew the convention was happening and you knew that probably many of your friends would be there in protest. Is that correct? A correct statement? And you were concerned that there might be problems in some people might need help, might need medical attention?
Yeah, and one of the things that people do at protests is they try to set up, you know, a medical response because we know that the police are going to use chemical weapons and they, in fact, used pepper spray pretty liberally.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they're going, history suggests that they're going to be physically abusive, in which they were, and that people are going to be traumatized and, you know, both right. physically and spiritually and emotionally. And one of the things in order to be responsible for our own actions and responsible for our own people, you know, in that form, in that sense of self-sufficiency, is that we set up a response to take care of them. And that involves doing a lot of training people how to take care of themselves.
The needle's dropping a little again there, Stan.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay, so here you are with the highest of intentions, standing alongside the road with your bus gone. This is insane, absolutely insane. So bring us up to date now, the main points of what has transpired and what you hope will transpire.
And so in the ensuing days, I began being the lead person on the bus, and began interacting with a variety of different bureaucrats and politicians and police officers. And we've reached a point of where we're at right now is that the bus has been released. I actually have the bus in my possession, and what we're doing right now today is that we're going through the bus and we're making a list of all the damage that was done and any possessions that were lost. And what we're doing that for is because we are preparing for a civil lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis for the violation of our First and Fourth Amendment.
All right.
And so I began interacting with the city of Minneapolis. It took me from Saturday till Tuesday to actually have any real conversations with anybody. And in the meantime, we had put out word over the internet what had happened. And it went over a very, very an international web of supporters, and the city of Minneapolis began had a deluge of phone calls that came from places like Scotland and England and Canada and Mexico and from all across the United States, demanding an explanation and demanding the release of the Permi bus. And, you know, support has been coming in monetary form. People are making donations, to cover the money that, you know, it is costing us to get our vehicle back. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have things like clothes. So, you know, people began bringing over clothes for us, and they began bringing over extra food. And we had this very, very loving network of people who very, very quickly organized themselves via the internet and began, you know, demanding of the mayor and of the city of Minneapolis that our bus be given back to us. And
fantastic.
On Thursday, the city had no other choice but to relent to a public pressure because people just couldn't understand why they had impounded the property of somebody who was teaching what basically is organic gardening.
And
you know, what is the threat?
And did they ever did they ever come up with something that they could pin?
One of the things that I like to explain to the listeners is that when we come into a community and we come to a location, we're very, very open about what we're doing. I mean, we don't have any sense that we're doing anything that we should be ashamed of or anything that we should be hiding. And I have interactions with the police all the time. I usually call them and tell them that I'm going to be at a certain location. I have the approval of the owners, and it's just a courtesy call because, you know, when somebody new appears in your neighborhood, the police are wary, and well, they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to make sure they know what is going on, I call them in advance. And when the police do show up, we always, you know, have an interaction with the police. And then oftentimes we've had off-duty officers tour our bus because we offer that to them.
Mm-hmm.
We have nothing to hide. And they did come up at one time and say that they saw us loading. Leaving the Bedlam, we, of course, had things that were outside the bus that had to come into the bus, like the you know, the structure we keep the chickens in and the buckets of their food in that. And they saw us loading this stuff up, and they came up with an idea that we were storing feces and urine that we were going to be throwing at the police. And
what a great idea.
And, you know, and what we were doing, and it was loading up the chicken food. And we, one of the things that we teach people is that we teach people how to use humanure to create compost to garden with. And if you go online, there's a guy by the name of Joe Jenkins who wrote the Humanure Handbook. And you can go online to humanure.org and download the book for free. And we have a humanure composting toilet system on our bus. And, you know, the police had been by earlier on their bicycles, and, you know, they asked what we were doing, and I told them what we were doing, and they went on their way. And certainly, had they expressed any concerns about any feces or urine that possibly was going to be used as a weapon, I would have gladly shown them exactly what we had.
Well, this wouldn't be the first time. This happened hundreds of years ago. The townspeople, I think there was an event that happened every year, and I think it was probably in England, where the priests would come out of the church in a procession, and the people were allowed to throw.
And they're looking at it from a completely different point of view. And the truth
sure.
of the matter is that I have no intentions of throwing urine, and I don't know anybody who has any intentions of assaulting the police with urine and or feces. It's a very, very convoluted idea, because they have to come up with justifications for what they do, and the truth of the matter is they have no justification.
Well, they've certainly got they've got an active imagination.
The only justification they have for their behavior is that their duty, unfortunately, has become to protect corporations and protect the state from citizens expressing their, you know, their disdain for what they are doing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that mm-hmm. it has become no longer safe to interact with your government that way. I would imagine that if Thomas Jefferson came back to Earth and was alive today, they would probably arrest him as a terrorist.
Very likely.
You know, he suggested that a revolution every 20 years was probably adequate to keep the government in line.
Do you have any idea how far away from the convention the protesters were held?
I don't know St. Paul that well, but I think the jail they put him in was relatively close to downtown. But I think it was on the other side of the bridge from the XL Center where the convention actually was. Certainly protesters got close to the XL Center.
That's what I really meant to be asking, is how close could a protester get to the convention?
Yeah, I didn't go out on the streets because I have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Oh my gosh.
I can't be exposed to chemical agents floating around in the air.
Oh my gosh.
So I don't know how close they actually got, but mm-hmm. I would imagine they could probably get to the front of the XL Center, but you know, and it's a very, very large building with parking lots surrounding it and all of that.
And it turns out there were a few in the convention.
There were people from, you know, very, very legitimate protest groups, Veterans Against the War, and Code Pink, and other groups like that, who got into the convention to where they can, you know, they could express their grievances against what the Republican Party and, you know, and to be fair, the Democratic Party have done over the last 8 years.
That's right. Well,
but the idea that we were going to use some sort of human waste to assault the police is just, you know, I have to admit, you know, certainly they sat down and had a very, very creative brainstorming session over what they were going to tell the public.
Well, there must be something about your bus in general that attracts their attention, wouldn't you say?
Hopefully it does. It's a big green school bus with solar panels on top.
Oh, wow.
The purpose of the bus is to attract attention.
Well, you certainly accomplished that, Stan.
And you know, there have been many other cases where, like I say, we have had, you know, I've had the police come up and I've spoken to them about permaculture and invited them to tour the bus, and they've all said the same thing. You know, I can't do that while I'm on duty for a variety of different reasons. One of them being is that that could be construed as a search. So if I have time off, become on the bus, and we have in fact had these officers on and tour our bus.
Well, that's smart of you to do that.
I want mm-hmm. the police to, I think everybody should plant an organic garden. I would really like to see a program across this country that is much like the Victory Gardens in World War II.
Oh, absolutely.
Everybody, and if you can't individually have an organic garden, at least every neighborhood should have an organic garden. I think it's something the government should help people with.
Definitely.
Like they did with the Victory Gardens. And I think that, if every police officer in the country went home tomorrow and planted an organic garden because of this incident, no matter how hard this incident has been and continues to be on my family and our supporters, I think that, a lot of good has come out of this incident then.
Wouldn't that be something? We should probably start a nonprofit organization to help police officers plant organic gardens.
I think that would be a wonderful form of outreach. I think if people could do that in their communities, I think the police would be, it would do away with that safety, unfortunately, developing with our law enforcement that is very, very dehumanizing.
Absolutely.
For them and for us. And it would make them feel better, because everybody feels better when they're in a garden.
Well,
and if Moscow, I believe, if the Moscow Police Department could develop a program to where they could compete with each other over who could have the best organic garden and offer some sort of, community recognition, I think that'd be absolutely wonderful. I think the entire, the entire country would be a lot better off, including the officers who, have a very, very difficult job to do and are put in a very, very difficult position.
Yeah.
Gardening is healing, and, the police need healing, too.
Well, that's a terrific attitude that you have, Stan. And I feel a little bit funny that I don't have your wife's name or your partner's name.
Delilah.
And I know your daughter is Megan and Delilah, and we have Rowan and Sage and Coco. How about the chickens? What are their names?
Well, we had three chickens, and unfortunately, we had a chicken who passed yesterday.
Oh, well, it's probably from stress.
Probably, and her name was Joan, and her full name was Joan Rivers, and she was named Joan Rivers by some people because she was very talkative.
Oh, gosh, how cute.
And then we have, and she was our New Hampshire Red, and then we have a little white leghorn whose name is B.O.B.
What is
and
it?
B.O.B.'s name, B.O.B., B.O.B. Initially, his name was because everybody was convinced he was a rooster. But then B.O.B. began laying eggs, removing all doubt. And so Bob became B.O.B. And then we have a black Osterloop whose name is Isis because she is the goddess of the clutch.
Oh, gosh. Wonderful. Wonderful. And happy family.
And then we have a worm bin.
And do they have names, the worms?
No, we have not named the worms.
Well,
there's really too many of them to name.
Well, Wiggles might be a nice name, and Slim. Anyway,
it all be Slim.
It's been a real pleasure, Stan, speaking with you, and I think you've had an effect on those of us listening, very positive effect, which is what you're intending to do with your life.
And I just want to say very, very quickly that we're looking at our schedule right now of where we're going to go to next, and we do have plans for at some point at a future date being in the Moscow area, and if people went to our website, they could then get to our email address, and if people in the Moscow area wanted to host an appearance of the Permi Buzz, we'd love to come there.
Let's get that website address.
The website is permibus, P-E-R-M-I-B-U-S, .tripod.com.
Tripod.com. And would you like to leave us any other information along those lines?
And our email address is skillstour, SKILLSTOUR, at
Wait,
gmail.com.
I'm writing this,
SKILLS.
S as in Sam.
Right.
Skills.
Tour, TOUR.
Mm-hmm.
At gmail.com.
At gmail.com.
And we would love to come to Moscow. We've actually been there a fair amount of times because we are based out of, we're from Montana.
I was going to ask you that.
Mm-hmm. And you have a wonderful health food store there, the co-op.
We sure do. Fantastic.
They make one of the, better cups of coffee you can get in the Pacific
yes,
Northwest.
Yes, they do. And are you a Montana native?
Well, yeah, no, I'm actually, my wife is from Wyoming. My daughter was born in Bozeman.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was in the military. I was actually born in Honolulu, Hawaii. But we've lived in Montana since 1988.
I see.
Uh-huh. On and off with a couple of trips. Every now and then we decide we have to go see the greater, wider world. And we usually end up coming back to the Montana, Idaho area because that's, you know, where life is the best.
You got that right, pal. It's fabulous here. And we all feel, I'm sure, privileged to live in a wonderful place.
If you live there, you know you're blessed.
That's right. Well, and we're blessed to have you speak with us today. It's been enlightening, and we do look forward to you coming here. Now, who's going to do this? Through your contacts, do you think you can arrange somebody to host you here, or how does that work?
Well, if people in the listening audience, for instance, are interested in hosting us here in Moscow, if they email us, you know, we do things like go to co-ops and pull into the parking lot and spend a day at the co-op doing mm-hmm. bus tours and doing workshops, and we have a Permy puppet show that we do for the kids. But we will also come to your home. We've done canning workshops in people's kitchens.
Wow.
And, you know, we do everything based on a donation basis because we want to include everybody in our training. So, you know, sometimes we're at people's homes. We go to churches, schools, community gardens, community centers.
So how does the hosting work? What do they do?
The way the hosting works is that we'll have a person who will oftentimes make contact with something like the co-op for us, or they'll give us a name of the director, and then we'll call, say, the co-op, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and make arrangements for the bus to be there. If it's at a private home, you know, we know what the criteria is that we need for the bus. You know, oftentimes, you know, we need a place to park it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that if you're in a municipality, if we're hosting in the bus and we're sleeping in the bus, we have to be off the public road.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the case in Moscow, but it's the case in many places. So oftentimes, we're parked in somebody's driveway, and, you know, we can do trainings in the bus. We can do trainings in a front yard. Oftentimes, we've done trainings in people's living rooms.
I get the idea.
More people's kitchens, and you know what it is that what you have to offer us, we make use of.
You're adaptable and resourceful.
And we're very.
And you don't
very
waste
adaptable.
Anything.
No, we don't waste anything, and we have our things set up so we don't have to say no.
Okay.
The only time we ever missed a training was because of this incident with the bus.
Wow. Well, I surely hope that can happen, and sooner the better, and I will be there if it does. And thank you again for a wonderful conversation, and the best of luck to you. I hope you get help through the ACLU. You pointed it out to me the first time we spoke that there are probably hundreds of people. Let's see, they say 800 people were arrested in St. Paul, and so there'll be many, many lawsuits, very likely.
Many, many lawsuits.
Yeah.
And we're in the process. We were advised to give them the weekend off so that they could decompress too, because they've mm-hmm. been dealing with a lot. They're already dealing with a lot of legal issues, and we'll be interacting with most likely the ACLU. And they're very, very, you know, they're very, very involved in the protests in this area. And we fully plan on pressing a civil lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis.
All right. Well, good luck with that, and thanks again. And
thank
hope to see you.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about permaculture in the bus.
Oh, you bet, Stan. And give those little chickens a pat on the head from Auntie Adrian.
Oh, I will. They're our permaculture superheroes.
Okay. Take care.
Okay, and thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.